Lazy Magnolia Southern Hospitality India Pale Ale. Which of those is the company?
Lazy Magnolia.
Lazy Magnolia is the company. Okay. We are not sponsored by Lazy Magnolia, but we are powered by it.
But we will take their money.
We will take their money and their beer.
And their beer.
Yeah. You're drinking something else. What are you drinking?
Yes, I am drinking a Leinenkrugel. Is that how you pronounce
it? Yes, Leinenkrugel.
Yeah, Leinenkrugel's Harvest Patch Shandy. This tastes like you're drinking a liquid pumpkin pie, except it's beer. So it's the best of every possible world. There is a perfect world, and it is Harvest Patch Shandy.
My question is, which has more calories, real pumpkin pie or the beer?
Probably real pumpkin pie.
Hmm.
They say that whenever you drink beer, most of the calories just don't get absorbed. Yeah. At least that's what I've read. I could be wrong. Let's fact check that, someone. Yeah.
But see, this is an interesting concept to me because I guess I've just assumed all along that when a food product says I am 160 calories, that is either all of the calories get absorbed.
Yeah.
Or that they've controlled for, you know, the average intake of a 200 calorie product is going to produce 160 calories.
I seriously doubt that they would. My guess is that they use a pretty simple calorimeter to do those things.
Well, then it becomes pretty interesting for people who are trying to exercise, right?
It does. I know, because I exercise a lot.
I exercise less, but the way that I had approached losing weight was we are essentially sacks of meat that burn X calories, and so you just plug in however many calories you need to get through your day and take in fewer than that. But that suggests that my calculus was all wrong.
No, it suggests that your calculus could have been better.
Okay. You're not as precise as you thought you were, but you're doing the right thing. Yeah.
The good news, I suppose, is that it puts a ceiling on it. So, you know, mm-hmm. you know, when it says I'm 160 calories, what that means is I am up to 160 calories.
Provided you're consuming the recommended amount.
Ah, well, you see, that's the cheat.
These are light chips, yeah. But then you eat the entire bag. I'm sorry, that's not going to do you any good.
That becomes a tough thing to do when you have things that are imprecise amounts. With salsa, for example, they don't say one serving size is 2 teaspoons. They say a jar contains about 5. What the hell can tell?
Are you supposed to divide the jar up into 5 equal portions and then consume those? Yeah.
I think what you're supposed to do is divide it into 5 equal portions and distribute it to the needy.
Oh, okay. Yeah. That's what I do with my salsa.
Well, that's great. I need a lot of salsa.
I do need a lot of salsa.
I had a joke. Do you remember the name of the card game we played?
Flux.
But Mike and I had a day out on Saturday.
It was lovely.
It was lovely, and we went to the 8th. I think it's the 8th annual Brown Coat Bash in Bloomington, which is an annual gathering for Firefly fans. Raises some money for a charity called Middleway House, which is a very good cause. Does shelters for abused women and so forth. Raised a bunch of money. And among other things, we played this card game, Flux. I think they're bringing out a Firefly version of this game, but it's this kind of insane thing where the rules are always shifting because there are rule cards, and as you put down cards, the rules will suddenly unexpectedly change, or the objective of the game will suddenly change. But one of the cards that they have is the is what I started calling the Barack Obama card, which is what I was thinking of in talking about the redistributing the booty, because you have to give up basically all your useful cards to a common pool, which are then shuffled and then divided out equally among all the players.
Yep.
It's a very socialist move.
So it's the Bernie Sanders card.
Card, right. It should have been more topical.
Yeah.
But we try to have a rule, you know, politics in the shelter, politics outside the shelter, Firefly in the shelter.
Definitely.
That's a good rule.
Yeah. Yes, it is.
Yeah. It's a very good rule. I've spoken to several of those people about politics.
Yeah.
And that is an excellent rule.
Yeah.
And actually, that's something that I find really interesting about Firefly, that the progressives who like Firefly can't understand why conservatives like the show, and vice versa. And to me, I cannot fathom why anyone to the left of center would not see that it's just a blinding indictment of big government. And they can't see why I can't see that it's a blinding indictment of corporatism run amok.
Well, because it's both.
Yes.
I'm not sure it is both, because remember, Joss Whedon is not in any way, shape, or form ambivalent about his politics, and it came out during the Bush administration, and I suspect that the elements of anti-government that we latch on to tend to be meant as indictments of the Bush administration, to the extent it's meant to resemble the real world in any way.
I mean, you have to go back and look at, of course, what's it based off of, and he read, I believe, was it Ambrose that he read? Some post-Civil War books, historical books, and he decided to base it upon that era. That it's quite clear that it is. And so, yeah, whenever you do something like base it off of ex-Confederates, you're going to have some anti-government stuff mixed in.
I still think it holds up as one of the few really believable future worlds, because the premise is essentially people will still be people,
yes,
which is where Star Trek goes horribly, horribly wrong in assuming this kind of the original series goes horribly wrong. TNG, I think, is a different animal, because TNG exists in a world where scarcity no longer exists. Right, the replicators have gotten rid of scarcity because the only thing that can't be replicated, and purely for dramatic purposes, is the replicator itself. And so I grant that they break these rules all the time, but when you solve the scarcity problem, then I do think it's fair to engage in more utopian speculation than you would. Because in the original series, you still have the scarcity problem. It's never really tackled head-on. And I think they talk about it, and they contradict themselves as to whether there's money. But as soon as you get that replicator technology, you're in a wildly different world where the old rules just don't apply anymore.
Well, I saw something interesting about this, and doesn't it just bump the scarcity down the line, because you don't have them replicating dilithium crystals?
That's true. There must be some unacknowledged limit.
Yeah.
Or at the very least, we've seen the Klingons still need to mine. Well, no, I suppose that's still in the original series era. But you're right, I've never heard of them doing it. And they don't replicate complicated parts on that. They don't replicate a starship.
Mm-hmm.
So there's still an investment of labor.
Yeah.
And so presumably a scarcity of labor.
But even if it was completely post-scarcity, which it appears to be post-scarcity in terms of foodstuffs and basic needs for most Federation citizens, not necessarily for everyone else, but there are problems that come into being whenever you have a post-scarcity society, and Star Trek lacks the imagination to think of what those problems would be.
Yeah, let alone thinking of solutions.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think what some of those problems might look like and whether they actually line up with what's on the show, because there is still some conflict, but a lot of the time it's contrived.
Mm-hmm.
Later on we'll talk about The Measure of a Man, when we talk about the AI piece. But there's some kind of slightly contrived conflict at the start of that episode between Picard and the JAG, because the JAG prosecutes, he had previously commanded a ship, I can't remember the details, but things had gone south, there was a court-martial, and she was on the other side of it, and he's visibly still ticked about this, as a person would be. But this seems an interesting move in Star Trek world, where inconsistently the characters occasionally act human.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
I think that ultimately the issue you run into whenever you get to post-scarcity is issues of motivation. If everything I ever need is at my fingertips, if all I have to do is walk to the replicator, ask for it, if all I have to do is step inside the holodeck to experience something, then what's the point of me ever actually going to do something?
Mm-hmm.
There's ways to overcome that, but I don't see any character struggle with that at all during that show.
Do we ever see Earth in The Next Generation? I don't remember.
Yes. Picard goes back to Earth a few times.
Okay.
We see Picard does...
He goes back to France and sees his brother.
Yeah, he goes back to France, sees his brother.
Yeah, that's the episode where they're not getting along.
They're raising up they're preparing to raise up a new continent between America and Europe. And he was going to Picard, the starship captain, and archaeologist is looking to oversee the project for some reason.
I seem to remember this went badly when they did it in Superman Returns.
Yeah, you'd think.
And not just because it was a continent made out of kryptonite. Mm-hmm. You know, I seem to remember things about flooding, death.
Yeah.
You know, on a huge scale. Because oddly enough, that water's got to go somewhere.
Got to go somewhere.
In the Expanse books, I seem to remember that they haven't solved the scarcity problem at all. But there is still this construct because they posit a very advanced welfare state on Earth, where people essentially choose basic support, quote unquote, and live a life of leisure. Or academia, or they can go out and do a real job. But it's not really made clear why, other than just personal ambition, anyone would choose to join the Marines or whatnot. Because if you can live a life of basic subsistence, that's very attractive, I'm sure, to academics. There's some truth to the idea that we only have the time to engage in academic and intellectual pursuits when the basic needs of civilization have solved things lower down the hierarchy of needs. And so if society is willing to have a welfare state that will support you, why wouldn't you if you are of an intellectual bent?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Would you?
Would I? Yeah, probably. Because I'm not really competitive. I think that to go into business, certainly into sports and things like that, you need to have that kind of competitive drive. Or at least entrepreneurial drive is kind of a subset of that. And I just don't really have that. I'm not really motivated to have a lot of money in that way. So I probably would. I think you would as well. Because we'd both be able to read a lot more books, have a lot more time.
I would be bored.
I think people who work for themselves solve that by developing particular routines. So like if you have a home-based business where you're really your own boss, the only way to succeed at that, and this is probably true for homeschoolers as well, you've really got to be a bit of a martinet about time management, and you're going to artificially construct the kind of workday conditions that would otherwise be imposed on you.
Well, I do that. I mean, I have my own schedule. Even on my vacation days, I have a specific set of tasks that I want to complete during my vacation time. I don't have free time in the sense that some people do. It's all very planned. There's always an objective. So I could do that at the same time without the necessary variety of a workplace where I wasn't completely in control. I think I would just get too bored.
Yeah. Coming back to Simon, you're very motivated internally towards a particular goal, towards acquiring more knowledge. Mm-hmm. And so anything else you can get rid of to work further towards that goal sounds great, and you'd totally go. You'd do that, and you'd have that motivation, and that'd be great. I don't have that strong of a motivation towards a particular goal. I acquire knowledge, but I don't dig deep into it. I'm a generalist. I like to just absorb vicariously and slowly. So if I were on basic support, I'd be afraid. I know myself well enough to know I'd just veg out. And so that's why I wouldn't take basic support, and that's what I'm afraid of. Most of the population has about my level of motivation.
Yeah, I think it's a terrible idea as a societal construct, because I think that's exactly right, that is what will happen to a large degree. You lose the motivation. I think for me personally, that would be wonderful if someone's going to come along and hand me money and food for no specific return, then that's wonderful. But yeah, I don't think that works as a way to structure society. One of the things that makes me awfully cross is when people insist on talking about socialism and capitalism as though we hadn't run a 70-year experiment in the last century on what happens when you put these systems into effect on a large scale, which one produces tyranny and which one produces happiness. We know the answer now. It's no longer a theoretical construct. When people like Schumpeter and Hayek were theorizing about this stuff in the 40s and 50s, that was one thing. But now we know the answer. You don't have to speculate on what will happen, and maybe people will lose motivation, and maybe the state will not be satisfied with dealing with just a narrowly defined economic tranche of affairs, because ultimately economics touches every aspect of individuals' lives, because we know what happens.
Yeah.
It's been tried multiple places, and it always has the same result, no matter where it's tried. And there are, of course, people who will insist that, well, that's just because it's been corrupted in each of the many places where it's tried, it's fallen prey to avaricious men. I just don't think that you run the experiment enough times, it becomes less convincing every time when it produces the same outcome, that this is just somehow, by pure accident, this has been corrupted.
I actually dispute your characterization a little bit.
Okay.
In the sense that I think socialism produces more tyranny, but capitalism has plenty of tyranny of its own. It's just a very different kind of tyranny.
Well, by tyranny informs in terms of government?
Both in terms of government, in the sense that business and government tend to interact with each other in certain ways, as well as in the sense that it's a market advantage for certain kinds of corporations to cooperate. That's why we have antitrust laws.
Mm-hmm.
So you can end up with the kind of government-style monopoly that we would expect in socialism, in capitalism. Now, the good news is that it tends to be more limited in its effects in capitalism.
Mm-hmm.
So you can mitigate to some degree the kinds of tyranny that you get out of socialism. And that's worth doing. You know, that's not a bad thing.
At least in the short run, yeah. Take the patent system, for example, where you confer a monopoly, essentially. If you have a product that becomes absolutely central and integral to the operation of society, such as Windows, the net effect is over the short haul, then you have handed that company an awful lot of power over individual people's lives. Even though no one, or very few people, I don't think, would dispute, at least in general terms, the broad structure of IP law and antitrust at this point. They might say the patent term ought to be shorter. But that would not change, even if you say, well, the patent term really ought to be, say, 25 years. Well, it's been 25 years since Windows 95, and we're no longer on that. So, you know, even with that kind of construction, though, what I guess I'm driving at is that it doesn't produce the kind of long-term tyranny, because over the short haul, yes, absolutely, you're going to license a company to only make this thing, and if it's the silver bullet product, then, yeah, sure, you're handing that company a lot of power. But over the longer haul, say about 72 years maybe, thereabouts, then that starts to change. So I see what you're saying, but it still seems different.
Well, it is markedly different. I mean, even if, because I think you're thinking of something a lot more sinister than just patents, whenever you're talking about the tyranny of the market and its interaction with government. I mean, you do have...
I don't know that I would say sinister.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's the wrong word.
Okay.
I would probably say inevitable.
Mm-hmm.
Because most humans are guided by self-interest.
Mm-hmm.
And markets function when you have perfectly rational self-interest.
Mm-hmm.
And we are not very good at perfectly rational self-interest.
Mm-hmm.
Our self-interest is, generally speaking, quite irrational. And so you have people making decisions out of short-term self-interest and say, hey, if I give money to this government official in the form of a campaign contribution, he might be inclined to look the other way when it comes to enforcing regulations that happen to apply to my company. When I donate a lot of money to this person's political opponent, he might be more inclined to go ahead and enforce those regulations on me. You get those kinds of inevitable human back-scratching behaviors that are just completely normal primate behaviors, and it really doesn't have anything to do with any grand conspiracy. It's just the inevitable result of human self-interest.
I mean, yeah, prime difference between capitalism and communism or socialism is that I can choose not to buy stuff. I can choose to go off the grid. If I'm in a liberal capitalistic country, no one's going to have a problem with that. They're going to let me. Whereas if I live in a socialistic, communistic...
Depending on how far you want to take it. I mean, if you want to be one of these sovereign citizen people and not pay tax,
well,
then...
But there's ways to not pay tax.
Mm-hmm.
If I don't earn an income...
That's true.
Then I don't pay tax.
Yeah.
At least, well, not income tax.
Yeah, I might have to pay sales tax if I buy anything.
Well, property taxes. But, well, little,
you know, I could move out to Alaska. Mm-hmm. Alaska doesn't have property tax. I can live off the land. And I could never pay taxes again in my life if I wanted to. I'd probably end up dead. But I could.
Don't we all in the end?
Well, yeah. We do all in the end end up dead. Normally not from malnutrition and or grizzly bear bites. but, yeah, I could. Whereas if I lived in a socialistic state, if you live in communist Soviet Union, communist China, you can't get away with that. If you live in Germany today, democratic, very capitalistic Germany, you can't get away with that. You know, it's not very authoritarian, but they want to know what you're doing, and they want to keep their eye on you.
Yeah, and they're not very authoritarian until you start doing something that they don't want you to do.
Yeah.
I got engaged in a discussion by, I think, a German, who said, well, give me, you know, in what way is America more free than Germany? And he wanted to start talking about issues not of freedom, but of justice.
Mm-hmm.
He wanted to talk about police brutality, and I said, no, that's a whole different category, and we can talk about that if you want, but you asked about freedom, so let's talk about freedom. If I want to put on a Nazi uniform and get together 1,000 people wearing Nazi uniforms and parade up and down the village square, a la the Skokie case, I can do that in America. What would happen if I tried to do that in Berlin? And of course, we know the answer is I'd be arrested and thrown in irons pretty quickly. If I want to practice... is it called Santeria? Is that the religion?
That's a religion. Yeah.
Right, and and I want to engage in various kind of quite kooky religious practices. I can do that in America within reason. You know, between the Employment Division against Smith case and the Church of the Lukumi cases, which was specifically about Santeria. I just don't remember what the details of the practice that they wanted to do, but it was relatively kooky. But no, you've got the freedom to do that. I know I can do that in America. I can't do that in Germany. You know, see what happens. I just went up to the range this morning and fired off a few hundred rounds. If I went out to a field in Germany and started firing off an SKS, what would happen in very short order? And when you had finished, or when you started prosecuting me for doing that, in America I would have the right to a jury trial for these criminal charges. Mm-hmm. Would I have the right to a jury trial in Germany? Mm-hmm. The answer is no. And so you can just go right down the list.
I really think what really drives it home for me is that in Germany you're not allowed to educate your own children.
Mm.
If you homeschool your kids in Germany, that's a criminal offense. And we have, there's a family here in the United States that for religious reasons they didn't want their children educated in a public school in Germany. So they wanted to homeschool their kids. And the German courts were going to take away their kids.
Right.
And so they came here and fled to the United States as political asylum. You know, it's crazy to think that to have people trying to get political asylum from Germany here, but something as simple as educating your kid is illegal over there because they think that the state... knows best.
Go ahead.
So out of curiosity,
mm-hmm.
and you've said that Germany is pretty capitalistic.
I think we're going the same way.
As far as the economy goes, what do you think causes this kind of authoritarian bent to crop up in spite of the wonderful freedoms of capitalism?
Because they have no... they've always been a very industrious people, but they have no history of personal liberty in the same way that we do. The German nation is built on the vision of Kaiser Wilhelm and Otto von Bismarck, and that's built on the fundamental flaw of this idea that there is such a thing that all these people are a nation and they belong together and there's a German will, and it It just makes me break out in the hives.
See, I don't know that I agree with that, and the problem is that then limits it to Germany. It's not like Germany is the only country that does that. I have a different solution to propose.
Uh-huh.
Or more to the point, Will Salatin in Slate Today has a different solution to propose. He was writing an article about Francis and said that Francis is not a liberal, he's a progressive. Keep in mind, I've written about conservatism as an epistemological proposition and a skepticism about how much people could know. I think that's pretty well grounded in the Burkean tradition. What Salatin suggests is that liberalism is grounded in uncertainty. You know, I know what I want to do, but I'm not sure that I want to force you to do that. Progressivism is based on an unqualified certainty that I'm right, you're wrong, and this is where we go. And Francis, by that measure, is in no way a liberal. He is very much a progressive. He has a vision of exactly where we're going to go. I think that that's the answer to your question. I think the reason why is good intentions. If you start from, or if you are unable to resist the pull of what is sometimes pejoratively called a nanny state, but I can't really think of a better way to sum it up that has the same kind of punch, where the idea is whatever is bad shouldn't be allowed. If you can't quite get yourself to a place where freedom means anything more than I have the freedom to do what I want, that doesn't mean you get to do what you want, because I think that's stupid, then this kind of thing is inevitably going to happen. If you just imagine it in these terms, why should we allow people to put on a Nazi uniform? Do you know how offensive that is? That's going to be triggering for some people.
Yeah,
I don't think we all allow people to do that. Well, you know, I don't want to put on a Nazi uniform and walk around anywhere, but if people want to, I tend to think that that there is a better trade-off. Because not because I think... If we could just ban Nazi uniforms, I would be fine with that, but you can't just do that.
Mm-hmm.
That's not how it works. Yeah. Because doing that concedes the principle that government gets to decide, or if you want to think of it in these terms, that the community gets to decide through the instrumentalities of government, that certain kinds of ideas are just so far beyond the pale that we can't possibly allow you to express those ideas, and which idea is going to be next.
And to bring it back around, because you're right in terms of that's the progressive impulse, and that does lay at part of the heart of the problem within Germany. But to bring it back around, the American progressive movement got its influence from Germany. It was Woodrow Wilson said that you could take a note of how a killer uses the knife and the elegance at which he uses the knife without going around and killing someone. And so he wanted to take the elegance at which the Prussians implement their state and use that in the United States for his own means. So it all ends up back in Germany. The progressive mindset got its birth there.
The interesting point that you made was that the distinctive part of American capitalism is that we have a tradition of personal liberty.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So what it seems to me that you're actually pointing to here is not that capitalism is the bigger factor in our freedom, but that a tradition of personal liberty is.
Oh, yes, yes.
I'd go even further, and maybe this is chauvinistic, and say there's the Anglo, what is now called the Anglo-American tradition. Most of what has gone wrong in Britain has come from Britain abandoning that tradition.
Mm-hmm.
America has kind of kept the flame alive. The school of thought that started there with people like Locke that really kind of reached its full flowering around about the time, keep in mind, The Wealth of Nations was written in 1776. It was a pretty good year.
Mm-hmm.
You know, mm-hmm. And there was just this confluence of thought and ideas that linked together, and liberalism, capital L, was both an economic proposition and a political proposition. And so they're interlinked in that sense, at least at the birth of the United States. I was just thinking the same thing when you were asking my way there, because these are capitalist countries. And I think the distinctive hallmark of we've got, you know, Houston, we've got a problem, is when you can't opt out of it.
Mm-hmm.
That's the point at which the state has gotten too big.
Yep.
There's no realistic means by which people can bail out. Which, I don't know when you would say that happened in the United States, but sometime in the 20th century.
Well, I mean, I can definitely think of one moment in recent history where the government has decided that you can't opt out.
Well, I mean more broadly than that. You know, in the 19th century, you could always go further west.
But right. I guess if we were going to highlight it in the 20th century, we'd have to I'd lay it at the feet of the wheat case in the FDR administration, where they said that a farmer producing wheat on his own land for his own consumption is still violating, is still engaged in interstate commerce somehow, and so falls under the auspices of the federal government.
I yield to no one in my criticism of Wickard, but I'm not so sure about that, because Wickard said that that farmer is touched by, or that the federal government can touch that farmer, that he's engaged in interstate commerce to a sufficient degree to support federal jurisdiction over him. I tend to think that's wrong.
Mm-hmm.
But it's still Congress's choice to do that or not. So I would say it was the passage of the National Industrial Recovery Act. I think it was NIRA.
Mm-hmm.
That's probably where things, or maybe that whole package of New Deal legislation, where you could no longer, in any realistic sense, opt out unless you're going to move to Alaska and live off the land and try and avoid property taxes and so forth. At that point, from that point on, it was a different thing, and I don't think we're anywhere near as far down the road as other countries, but certainly America is a less free country than it was a century ago. Oh, so having talked for 40 minutes, we should probably start the show.
I guess so.
We have two things. Let's talk about robot sex. Let's start with robot sex. There's a robot sex piece and there's an AI piece, and I think we should start with the... Actually, we should start with the Venn diagram and distinguish, first of all, and I'll put this in the show notes, but as I was trying to think about the two topics that you guys have put in the show notes, I drew up a Venn diagram because it seemed to me that we were not necessarily talking about the same thing. So the article on robots uses the term robots, and we're not talking about Ed 209 here.
Mm-hmm.
Right? There's a fairly fuzzy distinction between robots and androids, and a fairly clean distinction between AI and non-AI. And so in the Venn diagram, I tried to figure it out. Johnny Five is at the intersection between robots and AI, but not at the intersection between robots, AI, and androids, because an android is a robot that looks more or less human, or is intended to. An AI, of course, could be entirely disembodied. So Johnny Five is an AI... and a robot. Johnny's 1 through 4, and I don't remember how many there were after him, are just robots. They're not in the AI section. And then for androids, I thought about the Westworld non-AI androids. And there are kind of difficult cases on how you classify them. So, for example, the Sentinels in the Matrix movies, I really wasn't clear on whether you would classify that as an AI, a robot with AI, because it's really not clear whether they are just automata that are sent off by... There's a machine intelligence in the movie, but whether the Sentinels are just carrying out a program is really kind of unclear.
I would describe them as narrow AI.
Sure. Yeah. Semi-sapient, I think, is the sci-fi term. But then it's where you get into really interesting territory is the three-way intersection between robots, AI, and androids. And I had put in that C-3PO, Data, the androids from the Alien franchise, the Cylon organic models, and of course replicants. The Cylons the organic Cylons are obviously somewhat difficult to classify as robots, but since they classify themselves as machines, and since you kind of have this continuum between the Westworld robots, who are very definitely robotic androids, they're machines, and Alien franchise androids, who are a bit more machine-like. They're organic machines, but they're still machines. And then you have, I suppose, the replicants. And then finally you get to the organic Cylons, and you know, including that devastatingly gorgeous Cylon model. You know, you remember Dean Stockwell. Well, it's not really clear in what sense that it's a machine, but it's clearly a machine. Or at least it self-identifies as a machine. And then, obviously, you have the pure AI, such as the Master Control Program, Skynet, all this kinds of stuff. But I just thought that it would be good to start with that as a kind of a ground rule, and then we can talk about AI rights and robot sex. But let's talk about robot sex first. Do you want to talk about the article?
Yeah, so these people decided to create a website and write a bit of a manifesto. The website is Campaign...
The Spectre is Haunting Europe, the Spectre of Robot Sex.
Yeah, the Spectre, the Spectre of Robot Sex. It's a campaign against sex robots. And the gist of the argument is that creating sex robots further objectifies both women and children. It's going to lead to further intimacy issues, and it continues the prostitute John exchange, except now instead of the prostitute being a human, the prostitutes are robots. But this prostitute John exchange is inherently troublesome and should be done away with. So that's the argument against robot sex. And then IO9 did a piece in favor of robot sex, which was rather interesting, basically stating that, you know, we make these machines and so we can use them in the way that we see fit, that these machines could be used to treat people who have either sexual dysfunction or pedophilia, that by binding ourselves to saying no robot sex, we're bounding ourselves to the sexual hang-ups of today, and we should be more free and more open, and that having sex with robots can help further liberate us.
Would we treat other compulsive behaviors in a way? So suppose you mentioned the holodeck earlier.
Mm-hmm.
So suppose you have a Charles Manson kind of mass murder, someone who is inclined to mass murder. Would we say that the right treatment for him is to give him a holodeck and let him go nuts?
No, that's the fundamental problem with the IL-9 argument, is that that's absolutely the wrong way to treat that. It's whenever I was thinking about it, I was thinking about the issue people see with serial rapists. Serial rapists are going to start out stalking people, but that's not going to be enough for them. And so then they go move on to raping strangers. And then even that becomes too much, and so most serial killers, especially serial killers of prostitutes, start off as serial rapists who decide to up the edge. And so I think that with the IO9 piece and arguing that sex robots could be used to treat pedophilia by giving them an outlet, you're just encouraging it, and it's going to become not enough and encourage them to go out and victimize real children and do possibly even more horrific things to real children.
I think that's one of the arguments that's made in the article that underlies the manifesto. I don't know if you guys clicked through and read that,
yeah.
But I think she made that point that every time you see an expansion in this stuff, it leads to an increase in the corresponding real-world activity. And so the broader availability of pornography on the internet has not sated that desire of anything. It's increased it, and you see increased rates of prostitution.
Mm-hmm.
Right, and to anybody who knows anything about how the human brain works, that's exactly what you would expect. Typically, the way our brains work is, if we perform an action and it rewards us in our pleasure centers of our brain, or produces some other kind of psychological reward, we repeat it. And we try to find ways to enhance it. And what could better enhance it than having the real thing?
Yeah.
And so, to me, that's completely obvious, and I don't quite understand why someone wouldn't see that unless they just had no idea how their own brain works, which is entirely possible.
Mm-hmm.
It's entirely possible that people have no idea.
One of the points that you read off, I thought, struck me as well, and it rang a bell, so I went off and looked up what bell it was ringing. It's Paul VI. A man who grows accustomed to the use of contraceptive methods may forget the reverence due to a woman and, disregarding her physical and emotional equilibrium, reduce her to being a mere instrument for the satisfaction of his own desires, no longer considering her as his partner whom he should surround with care and affection.
Mm-hmm.
The sociological implications of the ready availability of robot sex, which is, but incidentally, what Futurama riffed on. I would not have remembered that section in Futurama as being quite so socially conservative, and I'm not sure whether they're poking fun at social conservatives or at prospective users of sex robots. Possibly both. It is Futurama, after all. But they were making, again, the same argument. What's going to happen? We talked earlier about incentives. Mm-hmm. And what are people's incentives in a post-scarcity economy? Well, if you think about sexual availability as a scarce commodity, you have a consumer that is, by and large, biased towards one gender, not to total exclusion of the other. But suddenly you have this availability. There are going to be consequences for society,
mm-hmm,
of that change. There's going to be consequences for society of, or consequences in terms of how men interact with women when after these things have become available. And you know, the Futurama thing made the suggestion that all human civilization has been an attempt by men to impress women. And sometimes men, and they came flesh of the word drama over the top of it. But there's some truth to that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not just. I mean, right now we're kind of still in the category of the part of the Venn diagram which is just androids. Mm-hmm. We're not talking about robots. There are already sex robots for women. You know, we're talking about rough human simulacra. And at this point, we're really only talking about the ethical consequences for the individual, for the consumer, and those costs on society. And I think, mm-hmm, when we start to get into that intersection point where you start to talk about AI, then you start to get into a subsidiary question about what are the rights of the robot. There doesn't seem to be any ethical problem with striking up a freely chosen relationship with an AI. Which you get in what's the Joaquin Phoenix movie?
Oh yes, her.
Right. Whatever else Gaius Baltar did wrong,
yes,
he did nothing wrong by carrying on with Number 6 volitionally after he knew that she was. Connect the right word on the Venn diagram, an android, an AI android. It's when you have these questions of you create sex robots, you have AI kind of crawling in from the side. At a certain point, inevitably, if we go down that road, you are going to have a moment of intersection between the two, or period of overlap, where you have semi-sapient robot or semi-sapient androids that are set to use for sex purposes, and at what point does that become an ethical problem as the robots progress along the curve from semi-sapient to sapient? You should introduce your AI piece, because I was going to say something about that, but we haven't really actually talked about it.
It was another piece written by, I think it was Schwitzgebel and Mara something or other. So this piece was by an academic, and this particular academic was making the case, and this is a very modest case, that there are possible instances of artificial intelligence that, if they existed, would obligate us to grant them certain kinds of rights. We would be morally obligated to those beings in certain ways that we tend to think of as rights. And I think the case can be laid out in two branches. The first case the author proposed was a branch in which the intelligence has rights by virtue of its attributes, essentially.
Mm.
That it has kinds of social interactions that we would think of as belonging to intelligent creatures, for example. That it's psychologically equivalent to an intelligent creature as we would think of it. The other was that we would have a moral obligation because we created it. Which I actually think is the far more compelling argument.
Yes, me too.
And the analogy that he used was to children. When we create children, we have certain moral obligations to children, quite independent of any rights they would be granted simply by their own attributes. And the reason that I think that's a much stronger case is that we don't grant any rights to dolphins, or porpoises or other cephalopods.
Mm-hmm.
And from a purely psychological and social standpoint, if we would grant them to an artificial intelligence similar to us, we ought to grant it to dolphins and other cephalopods. But we don't. And I think the reason for that is that intuitively, we recognize that a species, however porous the boundaries of that species may be, but a species has its own set of rights that it might want to enact, and those might not be the same rights that we would want to enact. You know, a dolphin may want a right to water in an entirely different way than we would want a right to water. The sort of water rights that a dolphin would need would be very different from ours. You know, they might need a certain number of cubic centimeters of water, for example, as an amount of territory that they could use. Whereas we would want perhaps a certain amount of liters to drink.
Hmm.
And so my guess is that even if we were talking about the same thing, a right to the same material, we and other kinds of intelligences would have differences as to how we would frame those rights. And just imagine if we're talking about entirely different kinds of materials that they would want rights to, how much farther that would go in terms of the differences. So I think that if we look at it merely as being a function of having certain attributes, that they would have rights simply by their attributes, then I would have to say that we have to let them decide what they want their rights to be. Because that's what we do for other beings.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if we take the view that they get rights by virtue of us creating them,
mm-hmm.
that complicates matters considerably. Particularly if we take those two views at the same time.
Well, can we not split up that there are different sources of rights?
You can say that
one of the things cited in the article is the Measure of a Man episode of The Next Generation that I talked about earlier. And one of the things that gets mentioned there is that Data has certain rights as a Starfleet officer, which I thought was an interesting way of putting it. They didn't talk about human rights, or they didn't say Data has rights. They say he has rights as a Starfleet officer, which mm-hmm. seems to suggest even if when he received his commission he had zero rights, we confer specific rights on Starfleet officers, just as under the UCMJ, an officer has particular rights that he has because he's a commissioned officer, not because he's a human being. So we can confer rights on dolphins or AI or whatever, regardless of what additional rights, maybe we better put this the other way around, but I've already started, whatever additional rights they might have merely by virtue of existing, or from some other source. You know, there are some rights that we have by virtue of these are human rights. The Declaration of Independence stuff. And then there are other rights that were given by constitutions and statutes and so on. And then there are other rights that we ourselves would claim, such as the right to educate our children, for example, or the right to a certain amount of water to drink. So can we not have it both ways?
We could. I'm curious as to what that would look like. So, for example, do we treat AI in much the same way that we would treat a child until it is sufficiently developed?
What would those markers look like?
I don't know what those markers would look like. I don't know that it's particularly clear for a child either.
Yeah. Well, but it's usually true, if only on an intuitive level, for an adult. And in lieu of anything more concrete, we use age.
Right.
And that's not a great proxy in all cases, but it's not a bad proxy within an order of magnitude.
It's not the worst that you could do. I just don't know of any way we could have a similar proxy for AI.
Mm-hmm.
And the other part of the problem is that not all AI will necessarily be developmental.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them will be learning machines.
Mm-hmm.
We will have that. And for those, we could say, all right, here's an arbitrary developmental marker. You know, once you can perform these tasks competently, you're an adult AI, and you can kind of go off on your own, and you have your own rights, and you can, you know, you can do your own thing. But what if you don't? What if you have an AI that's designed in such a way that it's perpetually below those developmental standards?
Would it truly be an artificial intelligence, and as we would normally think of that, if it were not capable of learning?
If it's not capable
of learning,
then
in what way is it not artificial intelligence? Then it's simply a collection of information. Is that not one of the criteria for being an AI in the first place?
No, it's not.
That surprises me, because it would be hard to imagine what an AI that couldn't learn would look like.
You really don't have to imagine that. And those were initially the kinds of AIs that were being built. When AI first started being a serious thing in tech circles and academic circles, the idea was to use classical logical frameworks essentially to preload the AI with lots and lots of information rather than having it engage in the kinds of learning behaviors that you would expect of a neural network. Neural networks were a later development.
Yeah, I guess I think of it, I very much think of AI in that, in terms of the latter. And that may be skewing the way I think about this.
But it's actually quite possible that we could have a quite intelligent AI that was not a learning machine.
Mm-hmm.
That's certainly not impossible. And it's difficult to know what the developmental cutoff would be in terms of granting it rights.
Yeah, I'm really iffy about granting AI rights. I'm not nearly as iffy about talking about our obligations towards such AI, which it's two different things. If an AI has rights, then it can make significant impositions upon me. Whereas if I have obligations to the AI, then there's certain things that I have to provide or I have to not do to the AI.
But is that not just another way of saying that it has certain rights?
No, because I think I'm thinking about if an AI is part of our society and if it has rights, then it can lay claim to political rights.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where I really get very, very iffy, is if you have an AI trying to demand political or economic rights. Because if you have an AI own stock, you know, it can make forecasts significantly faster than the rest of us can. It can buy stock significantly quicker. It could subvert the market if it wants to.
Mike, you do realize that already exists, right?
Well, yeah, but they're at our service.
You think so?
Like, who says whom?
We've had unpredictable results out of those.
Yeah, things. We have. And then we say, oops, and, you know, then pull the plug. Yeah. And so that's what I'm afraid of, if we give AI rights in the very robust sense.
Well, that's why I say you can split the baby and say there are certain rights that we think that, and I think that the authors would probably take this tack. There are certain rights we should concede, just as rights that might also apply to dolphins or so on. The right to not be butchered horribly,
mm-hmm,
without,
mm-hmm,
some kind of reason, as a very basic underlay. And then you could afford, by grant of statute or whatnot, other different rights. The thought that I had in mind was in 2010, no one proposes that HAL requires due process before he is essentially sacrificed as a concededly fully sapient AI. Not a robot, but an AI. But Dr. Chandra, the guy who created him, and so the parent in the analogy that was being made earlier,
mm-hmm,
is very concerned about HAL's rights and that HAL be given a free choice about whether, you know, this should be his fate. And everyone else thinks that he's nuts, but not because they think that, well, as a sentient life, HAL should be given due process rights, but because they don't want to die. you know, and so there's a somewhat different setup. But there you have again the felt responsibility by someone in a parental role, without anyone bringing up the proposition that that this being ought to have certain legal rights, that these parental faculties should be enforced by law. So maybe that's a model. I may have overread this article, because as I understood it, and maybe I took it a little further than it was intended, their point was essentially that because there is a conceivable subset of AI that could be created that would be indistinguishable from humans, and because we can't make moral distinctions between indistinguishable groups, therefore, because there could exist this subset, we ought to grant some level of AI rights more broadly than just to that group. And my thought, and this comes back to the sex robots thing and the various continua that go along, was that they can freely stipulate that premise, that there is a conceivable AI that would need to be conceded rights. The question then becomes, where along the continuum do you concede it?
Mm-hmm.
You know, where does that kick in? Hal does not have due process rights. Does number six? Does a Cylon Centurion? Who else we got on here?
What about Jarvis?
Jarvis, yeah, let's talk about Jarvis. Jarvis is presented in Avengers 2, and I'm ahead of myself already. Tony explicitly says he starts out as a language interface, and has grown to be something much more. So he's making these tactical decisions and running the Iron Legion in a way that it's almost inconceivable that he could be programmed to do. And certainly in his interactions with Ultron, you get very definitely the sense that this is a learning AI.
Mm-hmm.
In Civil War, if the federal government decides to shut down Jarvis, would they have to give Jarvis due process? Would they have to give Ultron due process? If Loki should receive due process under the laws of Asgard or anywhere else, should Ultron? Is Ultron owed due process? I completely forgot to put Ultron on the list.
I'd say no, but it's because, you know, he's not a citizen nor a resident, you know.
Do we usually say that that an illegal alien should, I suppose he is an illegal alien. So should Superman not receive due process rights?
Yeah, well, we gotta deport Superman and then build a wall.
If we just build a wall, we won't have to worry about Superman coming back in.
Yes. Very large wall between us and Krypton.
Just has to be a regular wall made of kryptonite.
Part of me wants to say that if Jarvis is able to plead to not be turned off, then we should at least consider it. But I don't think that Jarvis should, like, there should be a writ of habeas corpus for Jarvis. I tend to still be a bit speciesist or human.
Yeah, Peter Singer would call a speciesist.
Yeah, I'm more than willing to be that. I think that whatever rights that Jarvis might have as an AI, whatever rights he has to exist, it's not the same as my rights to due process.
I have a question about the artificial part. This kind of lives in the slippery slope argument. And there's a lot of slippery slopes going on. And I think what I was just describing is essentially a form of slippery slope, that if there is any AI that could have rights, do we dare draw the line somewhere?
Mm-hmm.
What about the... You both saw the show Dollhouse?
Yes, mm-hmm. I've seen a couple episodes. Okay.
Define artificial intelligence. If you could take a copy of Eliza Dushku,
mm-hmm.
or at least her brain, and insert that copy into someone else's body, which is kind of the reverse of the show. They essentially do the opposite. But same principle. You take a brain scan of someone, you capture them, and you stick that into another piece of wetware, namely a human. Is that artificial intelligence? It's artificially inserted intelligence, but there's that artificial intelligence. And just to tip the hand as to where this is going next, if you then upload that into a computer instead of into a piece of wetware, at that point, is it still artificial intelligence?
No.
It depends upon the capability of the technology. To my mind, whether or not the billion-dollar question is whether or not something is necessarily lost in the conversion, because it's being converted from organic to artificial to some sort of electronic binary something, and then back into organic. Mm-hmm. If there's something essential lost in that conversion...
I think you have to posit that there isn't. Because they don't show anything like that on the show.
Yeah. If there isn't, then no. But I'm very skeptical that there wouldn't be.
I think that's a good instinct, by the way. I also have in the back of my mind, though, I want to hear why you say no. But just to add another angle to it, well, what about the transporter in Star Trek, where the essence is extracted from every, in complete violation of every law of quantum physics known to man, you are being ripped out of your quantum state, passed through various digital filters, sent through essentially a very narrow force field beam to another location, and reassembled out of thin air. Similar kind of thing. You might suppose that something would be lost in the transaction, but they don't portray it. It's portrayed as a perfectly normal thing. But that too, it has the same kind of pass-through thing. Maybe you want to talk about why no?
Because the intelligence that we're talking about emerged organically.
Oh, okay.
If we're talking about whether it's organic or artificial intelligence, we're fundamentally asking a question about origins. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So if the intelligence arose organically and was merely inserted into a metal container, an electronic container, then it's still organic intelligence, though the container may be metal. Mm-hmm. And that's not to say that the container or the organic intelligence might not be changed by that interaction, but the origin of it was an organic intelligence. And in the same way, if you took an artificial intelligence and inserted it into an organic container, mm-hmm. like the Terminator, for example, if you're talking about a
Terminator is a really difficult boundary case.
Oh, yes, it is.
But we could take the replicants.
Yes.
Sure.
Yeah.
It's a better example.
But that's one of the reasons why that's a fascinating example is that, as I would recall, the replicants are not necessarily aware that they're replicants. That's going to be a bad day when you say, I want a jury trial, and they say, sorry, pal, you're a replicant.
Yep.
You know, is that just that we said that we would draw that kind of distinction?
I think that's actually a really good tie into some social debates we're having today.
No.
Self-identification.
That's
what if I want to self-identify as artificially intelligent?
Or vice versa, yeah.
I think most people would say, what if you wanted to identify as non-intelligent?
I think to answer your question, no, that's not just at all. And that's how, for me, that comes down to our obligation. Whenever we create something, we are obliged to tell them what they are. Mm-hmm. To lie to something like that. Because for me, all of this ultimately comes down to the reason why it's wrong is because it hurts me. I mean, I know that's in a way, but that sounds selfish or self-centered. But I could design a machine that liked being tortured.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
I could do that. I could design a machine that, you know, it needs to be tortured. But it'd be wrong for me to do that, and it'd be wrong for me to torture that machine because it harms me. It damages me as a person. And so I think, for me, ultimately, that's where all this AI stuff comes down.
It damages society through the proxy.
Does it make us more or less human, how we're treating these things?
That does bring us back, in a certain sense, to robot sex, because
everything brings us back to robot sex.
Yeah, you're essentially making an argument that it is wrong because it is not ordered towards the natural order of affairs.
Mm-hmm.
Which again is one of the things that Humanae Vitae makes an argument about, that sex within marriage is fine because it's ordered towards the correct. The God-ordered way that the universe is supposed to be, and that it goes wrong when that faculty is misused to ends other than the purpose for which they were created. Mm. You're saying something similar, that that you are perverting the natural order of things, not because the robot feels necessarily bad about being abused, but because you will corrupt your perceptions of how the world is ought to be and how you're supposed to interact with it, and through you, society's expectations can mm-hmm. become corrupted. If you treat pedophilia by giving them a virtual child to have sex with, that's not a very good treatment. And you're essentially, regardless of whether or not it escalates, you're still giving license to the idea, well, yeah, this is okay. It's only bad because it affects another person.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
There's nothing inherently wrong with it, so long as it doesn't affect another person. If you can find ways to, if you wrote fanfic instead, but I don't think we would say that. We would say that's a bad thing just to AOIPSO. So.
Mm-hmm. So with robot sex, do you think it will ever become a popular thing, a mainstream thing?
Yes. I think it will be very quick.
I think it will be a human right, nay, a constitutional right within however many years.
You see, the one place that I come down on the other side, at least I'm hopeful that it's not going to become a popular thing, is because of the Uncanny Valley. Mm. I mean, the Uncanny Valley is still an issue and remains so. There's people who have no trouble bridging that valley. But for most people, we're very, very good at telling whether or not something's human. We're fine-tuned to look at the little bitty details, and it takes a lot to power through those details to design something that can totally fool us, and or at least fool us to enough that we're not going to be totally off-put by what's going on.
Well, do you think that's because we would probably be, as a market,
mm-hmm.
trying to market these sex robots as human-like? Because I noticed that people have no problem with sex toys that provide the equivalent function.
Mm-hmm.
So, would those same people be able to handle something that was a reasonably good approximation of a human physically, that wasn't quite behaving like a human would?
What
would be the...
Because what I'm thinking is, because there's a difference between, sex appliances.
Correct.
And even smart sex appliances and a sex robot. And
yes,
perhaps that's where they're going wrong, because the sex robots that are being built, they're trying to approximate human beauty. Maybe if they just built the torso with the relevant parts,
that'd be fine. It seems just unbearably icky. But
imagine the cleanup.
But there are
the maintenance costs.
Mm-hmm. Could you imagine being
imagine the tech support?
Yeah, could you imagine being the service? Have you tried turning it off and turning it on again?
Have you tried just turning it on? but there are, I'm sure, other people. I mean, it depends on your level of... on what your needs are. I mean, I'm mm-hmm. sure that there are teenagers who would hit a bag if they could.
Oh, yes. But that's that's teenagers. So I guess, you know, adults aren't necessarily too much different. But I think that there'd be a top level of the population that it's not going to appeal to 70% of the population.
If we assume away the problems of AI and uh-huh. things like that, does it create a different category for Catholic moral thought, or would we just slot it into prostitution, masturbation, and categories like that?
That'd be all, classically speaking, that'd be put into pornography and masturbation.
Okay. So it just sits nicely in the existing categories.
Yeah. I mean, you can create...
I mean, the reason I ask is, I wonder, is it in any way more problematic from our perspective than what's out there already? Does it increase the availability or the likelihood of people to go outside of narrow structures? Well,
right now, no, given the high cost of it. But that is the problem, is whenever we're... Because, you know, it's not going to be enough for people to have sex with the robots. Eventually, they're going to want to marry them.
Yes.
And that's whenever...
Well, that's what, again, coming back into the AI piece.
Yeah.
You know, they... The more effective an android it is, the more likely it is that people are going to want to make mm-hmm. use of it for sex purposes. But as soon as you get into the AI piece on top of that, then... you have a bigger problem. Even if you're not talking about Trisha Helfer, if you're talking about replicants, the Alien franchise androids, I'm trying to remember any details about their construction. They were at least partially organic, and you certainly didn't have that Uncanny Valley problem. Mm-hmm. There was a great deal of verisimilitude. Even though they were quite clearly machines, in a way that replicants are much harder to see. You look at the replicant piece and say, this is much less obviously a machine.
Yes.
And as I say, I really don't know how the Cylon humanoid models are classified as robots, but other than the fact that they self-identify, maybe we should say that, they self-identify as robots for family reasons. One other thing I wanted to add on the Schwitzkobel and Mara piece... And again, it's more kind of in the area of a slippery slope piece, was they just assume that prejudice is a bad thing. Mm-hmm. They say that that if you're going to regard one, coming back to there could be AIs that are indistinct from humans because you can't morally treat a different two entities differently unless you can articulate a difference. They didn't put it quite like that, but I used that phrasing for a reason. Then you can't treat them any differently. And they say that you want to be able to point to a relevant difference between those two entities that justifies that differential treatment. Inability to provide such a justification opens one up to suspicions of chauvinism and bias. Well, that's true, but Edmund Burke had some things to say about prejudice and pointed out that there's some utility to it. The fact that we don't yet know and we have to speculate on where all of these lines are and how this is going to operate and what exactly this brave new world is going to look like should counsel a certain level of caution about mm-hmm. resolving it definitively. And you mentioned earlier, Sam, you used the word intuition. And I was going to, there was no opportunity to jump in, but I was going to jump in and say that a lot of this, it seems to me, is trying to backfill from our intuitions. And going back to Measure of a Man, Picard's intuition is that Data can't possibly be just a machine or property because he's his friend. And so he knows the right answer and goes looking for a principle that justifies that being the right answer. But Picard is prejudiced. He's prejudiced because he knows the particular individual that they're talking about. But it wouldn't make any difference if he had simply, you know, I have known androids. You know, and androids as a class have always seemed very decent people to me. It wouldn't make any difference if it were personal. It's an argument that arises from prejudice, and they come up with clever reasons to explain that. But there's some value in our intuition is that there have to be some rights. And that's really just a function of prejudice, but there's some value to that. There's more, perhaps, value in that than Schwitzkobel and Mara say.
But prejudice is the most undervalued trait in today's society. It's because I think it's a byproduct of the idea that we should all be and all are perfectly rational beings, combined with the postmodern viewpoint of there being no right answer. But a prejudice is just our assessment based off of incomplete knowledge. Mm-hmm. And we do that all of the time. We make generalizations all the time. If we weren't prejudiced, mm-hmm. and we didn't make generalizations, we would have died off as a species.
Burke's line, which I made a note of because I didn't want to get it wrong, was that he is bold enough to confess that we're generally men of untaught feelings, that instead of casting away all our old prejudices, we cherish them to a considerable degree, blah, 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 blah. We're afraid to put men to live and trade each on his own private stock of reason, because we suspect that this stock in each man is small and that the individuals would do better to avail themselves of the general banking capital of nations and of ages. Mm-hmm. And when you deal with a new phenomenon, something that is AI would undoubtedly be new, no matter how much we've thought about it recently, when it finally happens, it's still going to be a new thing. We're going to have to figure out some way to relate to it. Mm-hmm. And the best way to relate to it is to relate to it through what we already know and what we've already experienced, which is to say, not taking it on its own merits. It's to say, acting in a way that's prejudiced, both to its advantage and to its possible detriment. Your point about the dolphins, we would be very chary about saying that AI couldn't conceivably have rights because couldn't conceivably be intelligent in the same category that we are, because we have experience with Guinan in The Next Generation brings up the slavery analogy. We have the dolphins analogy. And so what we know already informs the way that we approach new phenomena.
Yeah, so one thing I'd like to know about these robots, particularly the AI, is how they would feel about beer. would we have AI taste testing beer?
Now, I believe Futurama has an answer to this question.
Yeah, Futurama has lots of good answers to lots of those questions.
Well, you're talking about intoxication generally or beer specifically?
Well, beer or other flavored drinks.
Okay.
And it would be interesting to me to see if perhaps we would choose to have an AI be a judge in a taste testing contest.
Mm.
Because we would imagine that the AI would be more objective, which by the way, would be wrong. Because if we're right about the AI, it's entirely subjective.
Mm-hmm. But it could better analyze the components, provided that we provide it with the right instruments.
Correct. Instruments and the right algorithms.
And then, perhaps given it, if we provide it with enough beer, it's going to produce the perfect beer, along with a whole bunch of crappy beers.
But then we would have to know something about the mediation of our taste buds. Right? How do we know that it's going to be able to perceive the data that we would generally classify as taste? In the same way that we do. I mean, what is the correct unit of taste?
There's ways to get around that. If you...
Ingredients?
Yeah.
Parts per million?
You provide it with the ingredients, and then you provide it with human response to each of those ingredients, mm-hmm. and to the ingredients mixed in. And it's able to... I mean, we could do this tomorrow with Watson.
Mm-hmm.
It's able to take those ingredients... take those human responses, analyze it, and come up with things we've never thought of.
That'd be an interesting experiment. You give Watson that kind of data, and then we have Watson make predictions about responses to various...
Mm-hmm.
I was going to say flavors, but I mean, you could do it with stimuli more broadly.
Yes.
And see how it correlates. How close does Watson get? Because even though people have generally different tastes... I may or may not like pickled onion, or you may have a different opinion on pickled onion. There are plenty. None of us is going to pick up a rock and go, yum. you know, most people like cotton candy. They may not choose to eat it because they're worried about the effect on their teeth or their general health, but most people would agree it's not an unpleasant tasting thing. So even though there are variations in taste, those are within broad parameters.
Is this almost a giant test for AI? Seeing if we can create an AI and see if it can find something it finds enjoyable.
Oh, yeah. And that's one of the capacity for pain or pleasure is one of the indicia that people use.
Well, yeah. I mean, we could build an AI with a capacity for pain or pleasure.
Yeah, that's the one Peter Singer uses.
That's very doable. But there's a sophistication to finding something enjoyable as opposed to just a pain pleasure response, I'm sure
we could create an AI that codes particular data as painful and particular data as pleasurable.
Mm-hmm.
But this is where you start to get into the jump from a mere aggregation of data into artificial intelligence.
Mm-hmm.
It has some capacity to understand what those things are. And as you say, to develop tastes of its own.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
What if we made an artificial intelligence and it was kinky? It liked pain, you know.
That's certainly possible.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah. Turn me off and then turn me on again.
Yeah,
yeah,
yeah. No surge protector tonight. I'm feeling risky.
I think we have a show title.
I think so.
Surge protector tonight. Yeah. Are we done?
Yeah. On that note, good night, everybody.